I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I'm very happy to be able to welcome to the program Brenda Wineapple. Brenda Wineapple is an author, a historian. She has written a book, an important book that I spent a lot of time this past weekend with, concerning the first impeachment in U.S. of a sitting president, anyways, in U.S. history, that of Andrew Johnson in 1868. It's called The Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson and the Dream of a Just Nation. Brenda Wineapple, it is my good pleasure to welcome you back to this radio station.
Great to be here. Thanks so much, Mitch.
So what are your thoughts here as somebody, and I specifically read the chapters on the Senate trial in your book over the weekend,
as I was
also watching, went to C-SPAN's archives online and was watching the Senate impeachment trial too, just because I've never covered one of these before. I've covered almost everything that Congress does except for this. So what were your thoughts watching this?
I had so many thoughts. It's going to be hard to get them all in a very short period of time. One had to do with the difference between, or as we understand it, what the House of Representatives is tasked to do and the Senate is tasked to do. In other words, the House of Representatives votes to impeach, which they did in the case of Johnson and they did in the case of Trump just recently, and then there's trial in the Senate. The House is not mandated to hold an investigation, and so the conversation about the investigation that the House held, you know, whether it goes fast, whether it goes slow, whether there were sufficient witnesses, I mean, I think is a little bit of a red herring. In this particular case, there was an investigation, and I think as Manager Schiff, Adam Schiff, pointed out, you can call witnesses both in the House and in the Senate if you want to. So I think that it's interesting to sort of understand that the Senate is tasked with the trial of the impeached civil officer, in this case president, and then there are no rules for the conduct of that trial, so that when Mitch McConnell and others talk about precedents in the Clinton precedent, they make that seem as though it's hard and fast. When I heard Mitch McConnell earlier today, he seemed to suggest that he was following the Clinton playbook, but that's not constitutional. That was just his choice. And then most recently, there was a change, as you pointed out, that suddenly we're going to have 3 days of testimony, or, you know, of the whatever you call it, the
oral arguments.
Managers, oral arguments. Thank you. Oral arguments, and now the House investigation will be read into the Senate trial, where it wasn't going to be before. So by that, we can see that there can be flexibility in how the Senate decides to conduct the trial, and I think it's important to remember that. The second thing that I would say too is that the discussion that lawyer Cipollone was talking about the, you know, stealing of an election, the impeachment is an orderly process. It's a constitutional process. Johnson in 1868 could have faced an election. It just happens he wasn't nominated, but he was planning to run again, and Trump is planning to run again. This has nothing to do with elections, which determine policy. An impeachment vote and an impeachment trial is about something else, and that's about breaking the law, to define it narrowly, or broadly speaking, maladministration and malfeasance in office. So those are just some of my thoughts.
In going through your book, I really noticed concerning the Senate trial that it was the place to be when it first began, that the Senate even had to, for the first time, print tickets in order to get in and view the trial. Now, you could, you know, it's still the same Senate chamber today. You can go in there. Right. It's free. It's usually not crowded. You can stay in there as long as the Senate's open or as long as you can stomach it, right? But for this event, this was, you know, dubbed the trial of the century, and that the Republic was on, you know, on the edge here of what would happen to the Republic. And you had who's who, especially from the political aristocracy showing up for these, you know, who got these tickets, because I guess like members of Congress and people participating were the ones.
If you knew someone, you could get a ticket. Walt Whitman knew someone, so he went.
Walt Whitman went to it?
Yeah.
Wow.
So you never know who's going to show up. Anthony Trollope, the British novelist, when he was visiting the United States, he went once. He was seen there once. So you're absolutely right. It was the trial of the century. It was the place to be. Newspapers covered even what you were wearing, particularly for women in the ladies' gallery, or what was called the ladies' gallery.
And so, women dressed up. They had their opera. Glasses
they had their opera glasses, and so did the men.
And then
the journalists who were there scurried out as soon as there was a break or an opportunity to telegraph their, what they had seen, what they had heard to the various newspapers for which, they were writing. So it was, there was no TV, as we know, and there was no social media, but it was covered. It was extensively covered.
And then what, a week later, everyone was bored out of their minds?
Well, they became bored, and you can see how it might happen if what happens is devolution, a kind of things devolve into legal wrangling about what does, if you remember from Clinton, what does is mean, and you start getting questions about perhaps even today, what does due process mean? Who is denied due process? So that there is a lot of procedural arguments that go back and forth that do try people's patience, especially since there'd never been an impeachment trial before, and people were, hoping, they were very anxious, but also hoping for some fireworks, and there weren't always fireworks, just as in any court of law. There's a lot of, there's a lot of nitpicking.
Yeah, I mean, that's the first trial that you have, an impeachment trial, at least of a U.S. president. So,
right.
I mean, that took a lot. I mean, it took what we're going to witness today took them a lot longer to finally come up with how this was going to look.
Well, yeah. I mean, they actually did it fairly quickly in the sense that it was a little different. It was still partisan, make no mistake, but certainly the Republicans who were impeaching Andrew Johnson, a Democrat, they did have the majority. So it was a little different than today, where the Republicans have a majority in the Senate, but they're not the group impeaching Donald Trump. So things could go a little bit more smoothly. But of course, the president in that case, Andrew Johnson, had very, very gifted lawyers, no doubt about it. Interestingly enough, and this may have a parallel with today, a lot of them were on record saying, well, at least in confidence, that they didn't much like Andrew Johnson, but they felt that it was their duty to perform this service for the country, or to take another tack to, protect the office of the presidency.
Now, we've talked about this a lot in previous broadcasts when the process was in the House of Representatives, and that is that the impeachment of Andrew Johnson was really about the future of Reconstruction and race relations in the country.
Right.
And that Andrew Johnson was self-proclaimed white supremacist who thought the government should only be for white males. And this angered Republicans, especially radical Republicans. And I want to talk about somebody we haven't dived into a lot about this, because he was a floor manager in the Senate impeachment trial. And that is what I will call the great Thaddeus Stevens. So he wasn't always loved by his fellow colleagues back in the day from Pennsylvania. This is this is sort of the leader of the radical Republicans who, you could argue single-handedly by his control of the House Ways and Means Committee, ensured that the Civil War was about slavery, wanted full racial equality in the South after the war, wanted to ensure the military was going to remain in the South to oversee the lofty ideals of Reconstruction. He was a floor manager, but he was kind of on his deathbed, wasn't he? He had to be carried into the chamber.
Yeah. Yes, he was one of the managers, there was no way that he would miss this trial. He stayed alive almost by sheer will, and he was a very willful person. And yes, there were young men who carried him in every day. And when he wanted to read something, his voice cracked, and he would have to have another one of the managers speak for him. But he was still fourth, nonetheless, because it was he who made sure that the 11th impeachment article against Andrew Johnson, the one that was very adamant about undoing the damage to the country that Johnson had done and could do in the future by denying the legitimacy of Congress and failing to execute congressional laws, particularly Reconstruction laws, particularly laws having to do with civil rights, particularly laws that granted black men in the South the vote. So he was still very, very adamant about that at that time. But he wasn't as forceful as he had been earlier when he was younger or when he was not ill. And who knows, things may have gone differently if he could have been the one who was arguing the case instead of the very deft, very brilliant lawyer named Benjamin Butler, who did take over. But he was an abrasive figure for sure. And of course, there were other agendas in the Senate then as there are now. But Thaddeus Stevens is a very unusual person. Just to kind of put him in focus for your listeners, if they had never heard of him, nice thing I like to sort of thumbnail sketch is when he found out toward the end of his life that the cemetery plot he bought to be buried in was in a cemetery that did not allow black people to be buried there, he immediately sold the plot and went to an integrated cemetery and said that he wanted on his tombstone words to the effect of, "I want to stand for the equal justice in death that I've always fought for in life."
He was also disabled. He had a club foot
yes.
that caused him
mm-hmm.
to limp, and this is a time where that actually mm-hmm. would be used against you.
Yes, of course. I mean, it's something that would be caricatured by malicious people, and even in 1915, Birth of a Nation, if you take a look at that film, you know, which horrified many people in 1915, and still does, there was a figure based on Thaddeus Stevens who is seen to be a kind of twisted, gnome-like person with a limp that was said to be a sign of the devil. Clubfoot was said to be a sign of the devil. So he's made into this diabolical figure. And that's in many cases how he came down to us through history, when history was written as a kind of lost cause, and into, I think, maybe the early 60s, when suddenly historians, and certainly the larger public, historians had already started to look at what had happened again from a different point of view.
Oh, that's interesting. I did not know that about Birth of a
yeah.
Nation and the betrayal of Thaddeus
yeah.
Stevens in that film.
Take a look at it.
I'm going to. No, I am. I'm going to.
It's very, very distressing when you see, and you know, audiences would have known in 1915 for sure that was the Thaddeus Stevens figure. And even if you take a look at Profiles in Courage, which has recently been on the front burner, that the chapter that praises Kennedy's chapter on Edmund Ross, who cast the vote that kept Johnson in office, Thaddeus Stevens there, too, is depicted by no less than John F. Kennedy or Ted Sorensen, whoever wrote that book, as a kind of maniacal, diabolical figure. It's just really astonishing.
John
and that
Kennedy
was 1956. Late. I mean,
yeah.
You know, it seems a long time ago to us, 70 years, but still not so long ago in terms of how people think of John Kennedy, for example.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Thaddeus.
Yeah. And that
yeah.
comes right out of, that comes out of Birth of a Nation, too, that chapter, it seems to me. But
interesting. I'm going to have to look into all
yeah.
of that.
You've got your homework now. Man.
Yes, as I do every day.
Yeah.
You just added
don't
to
we
it.
All these days, right? A lot to learn.
Yeah. You know, today there are critiques, yeah. and I'm sympathetic to the critiques from the left about only impeaching Donald Trump because of the situation with Ukraine. When you have all these other things you can impeach him for. But I also kind of think back to the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. Thaddeus Stevens spent, what, 2 years trying to impeach Andrew Johnson, and he never had the votes for the real reason that they wanted to impeach Andrew Johnson. It wasn't until there was the violation of this very obscure law called the Tenure of Office Act that, and you could draw a line to, you know, the bigger reasons, but, you know, I mean, that was the, you know, 9 of the 11 articles of impeachment were based on the violation of this obscure law. That's inevitably what he had the votes for. So that's what he had to go with. I mean, I kind of see that now with Ukraine situation. I think there's a good argument you could and maybe should have impeached Donald Trump over other things as well, but you didn't have the votes. This is what you have the votes for.
Well, exactly. And if you take as a kind of example, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, who was hesitant and reluctant to impeach Donald Trump, much as she overtly and very strongly disagreed with so many of his policies, whether it had to do with immigration or taking children away from their parents, whether it, you know, they're just, you know, withdrawing from various treaties, whatever it happens to be. But she was very clear that you don't impeach for differences of point of view. And when the Ukraine call, the information about that was revealed, what she said was, now, this is not a question of policy, this is a question of protecting the Constitution. And what's interesting about the parallel that you're drawing, in 1868, or earlier, as you mentioned, there have been many who were horrified by Andrew Johnson's policies vis-a-vis the South, and his white supremacy, and his basically ability to foment violence, particularly against black citizens, or to even deny black people's citizenship. But they were reluctant. There were moderates, there were conservatives, there were progressives in the Republican Party. Andrew Johnson had the unique ability, or maybe not that unique, but he had the ability to unite all elements. And when he actually broke a law that was passed to constrain him so that people in the South were safe and that they could go to the polls unmolested, then that was too much. That was a bridge too far.
I think we're going to have to leave it right there.
Back?
Brenda Wineapple,
right,
thank you so much. Well, I'm hearing I'm not having it on my screen, but I'm hearing voices, so we better go look into this. Brenda Wineapple, author of The Trial of Andrew Johnson and The Dream of a Just Nation. That's the subtitle. The book's actually called The Impeachers. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch. Take care. Bye-bye.